And welcome back to Regionally Speaking. I'm your host, Dee Dodson. Coming out is a lifelong journey of understanding, acknowledging, and sharing one's gender identity and or sexual orientation with others. It may be quick and easy for some, or longer and more difficult for others. Joining us today to discuss how we can support youth members of the LGBTQ community is Troy Stevenson, Senior Campaign Manager for the Trevor Project, the world's largest suicide prevention and crisis intervention organization for LGBTQ plus young people. Troy, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you so much for having me.
Troy, so you're here with us today to talk about how community members right here in Northwest Indiana can support as well as serve as an ally for LGBTQ plus youth. But before we get into that, can you please share what is the Trevor Project and what was the genesis of this organization?
Sure thing. The Trevor Project is the world's largest suicide prevention and mental health organization for LGBTQ youth. We offer 24/7 and free crisis services help via phone, lifeline, text, and chat. So we also run a service called Trevor Space, which is a social networking site for LGBTQ youth. It's limited to 23 and under and operates an innovative education, research, and advocacy program. We do. As a totality and technology programs. So the genesis of the organization was just over 20 years ago. There was a film that highlighted the bullying aspects that were going on. And in putting this short film out, the founders realized that there was a need for crisis services for suicide intervention and prevention. So that was where we grew from. And we've grown over to the years to the world's largest from that small genesis.
So, Troy, you just mentioned that the Trevor Project offers access to a crisis counselor 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I think that I saw that is via online chat, text message, or even a phone call. This crisis line allows LGBTQ plus youth access to a trained counselor if they are struggling to find answers as well as information, but also allies are able to utilize this crisis line to get tips and tools that they may need to help someone else. So I can only imagine that this crisis line provides a safe space. Do you know on average how many youth take advantage of this crisis line?
Hundreds of thousands every year. So it is ramping up year after year. And as I'm sure you could guess, as these negative aspects of legislation around the country have ramped up, we've seen increases. So we're there for young people, regardless of what's going on in their community, to make sure that they do have that safe space to come to. And like you said, and I said earlier, we even have over the years created more usable systems for young people, because a lot of youth, especially LGBTQs, aren't as comfortable using a telephone because in their home they can't always be as vocal. And being able to use text and chat has allowed them to be safer in seeking help to prevent suicide.
Well, you know, Troy, I never even considered the safety and security being able to communicate via text or online chat, what that would provide for youth. So thank you for adding that. I never even considered that. Continuing on for just a moment. So, you know, I shared that I spent a lot of time going over the Trevor Project's website because there are just mounds upon mounds of information available on the website on everything from sexual orientation. And I also stumbled upon the guide, The Coming Out Handbook, that offers tools to help young people not only understand, but also express their identity. And one thing I learned in that is that there is really no one specific way to come out. So can you just take a moment to just kind of unpack what this resource has meant to help youth come out on their own terms?
I mean, I think it is a process for every individual. And I mean, I look forward to a day where people don't have to come out, where cisgender and straight folks don't have to come out as who they are. So I look forward to when we don't either. But it's just really important that young people especially are allowed to come out at their own pace and in a safe environment. So that's what we work every day through our advocacy research education programs to try and make the world a little safer for especially young LGBTQ youth.
So, Troy, you just said something that I hope our listeners didn't miss. You shared that you look forward to the day when members of the LGBTQ community don't have to, quote unquote, come out. So just parking for a second on the whole topic of coming out. Coming out is a big and a personal decision. And coming out is also a lifelong journey. But I also think that it is important to highlight that coming out is a lifelong journey of understanding, acknowledging, and sharing one's gender identity and or sexual orientation with others. And so it may be quick and easy for some, or longer and more difficult for others. So for teens that may be considering coming out, I can only imagine that one of the concerns, or maybe even fears, is that they won't know how people will react until the time actually comes. So what can allies do to support teen members of the LGBTQ plus community?
Once again, it's the creation of that safe space for them. We have found through our research that just one affirming adult, one supportive adult can exponentially decrease the likelihood of suicide amongst youth. Our 2022 national survey on LGBTQ youth mental health has found that 45% of LGBTQ youth seriously considered attempting suicide in the last year, including more than half of transgender and non-binary youth. So if you think about it, if a reduction of approximately 40% likelihood of suicide attempts is because one person in their life supports them. That goes up if it's a parent, that goes up if it's a family member. You know, that is such a vital resource. That's how someone can be an ally, is making sure that young person doesn't feel alone in that coming out process. I remember myself in the 90s, late 90s, when I was just coming out, there was such a great fear. It wasn't safe. I was in suburban Oklahoma City and didn't know how my family would react. I didn't know how others would react. And, you know, my first boyfriend had been subjected to sexual orientation change efforts, which is they call it conversion therapy, and ended up completing suicide. One of the reasons being because of the fear of that rejection, the fear of being sent back into conversion therapy. And I think that's what a lot of folks face. Over the years, we've seen a lot more accepting folks and a lot more elevation of the issue, a lot more representation in media. But it still takes that one-on-one human contact of somebody saying, it's okay to be you, to really help. And that's the most important thing we can do is really create a society, work towards creating a society that is supportive. And being an ally in the home, at school, in a local community is one of the things that do that. We see over 40% of homeless youth or youth that are housing insecure are part of the LGBT community, when probably 5 or 6% of the population are LGBTQ. So that just shows the amount of family rejection and fear that's out there. So once again, I think the most important thing people can take away is making sure that they are that accepting person. And the more accepting people that are in the lives of young queer youth, the lower the likelihood that they will end up facing suicidality.
Troy, let me just pause for a second and thank you for that moment of transparency and vulnerability, sharing your personal story, the personal story of your first boyfriend who sadly was successful in completing suicide. I really and truly believe that story will help at least one person who's listening to us today. Okay, so let's just sit right here for just a second and speak about family rejection, right? Parents of teens, and I'm the parent of several teens. And so I can attest to how difficult it is just to communicate with your teenager, just in general, right? But for parents of LGBTQ plus youth, can you offer some do's and don'ts for when their child comes out to them? You know, are there words that they should and should not say?
Once again, the most important part is creating an accepting and safe environment. One of the worst things that can happen for a young person is family rejection, and that can come in many forms. It's not always just being removed from the home or kicked out of a home, but it can be social isolation. It can be many things, and it's just important to make sure they know they're loved and they're accepted and they can be who they are. One of the other most important things is to educate yourself. I think more and more people in society realize that their child could be LGBTQ, and it's something that I think more folks need to educate themselves on in general, to just be there to listen and to watch for signs of fear and depression in their child, and making sure that once again, that safe and accepting space is there when they do decide, if they do decide to come out.
We're speaking with Troy Stevenson, Senior Campaign Manager for the Trevor Project. So, Troy, I personally believe that representation matters. I mean, we are now living in a world where President Joe Biden named the first Black and openly gay press secretary. And you see more and more television shows with representation of members of the LGBTQ community. You know, I think about shows like Modern Family, for instance, right? So would you say the society is more accepting of the LGBTQ plus community?
I think we see more acceptance every day. And I think it's important to say that not only was this the first Black and LGBTQ press secretary, it was the first Black press secretary and the first LGBTQ press secretary. So it was both. And I mean, that's representation on both aspects. But yes, I think that we see greater acceptance. And with greater acceptance, we see greater pushback in some cases from a very vocal minority of people. So what you're seeing in legislation that's being presented across the country, especially this last 2 years and really going back for a decade and more, is that as representation and as acceptance grow, sometimes that also includes some negative reaction. So that is also one of the reasons that we at the Trevor Project are there to make sure that that young people have 24/7 access to crisis services, and why our advocacy department and our research department do such amazing work in pushing back against this kind of legislation and showing the truths that are out there in research and what things like family acceptance and the acceptance of a single individual can do to save the lives of the young people in their lives.
And finally, Troy, so I shared earlier with you that I spent a lot of time looking at the Trevor Project's website, and I stumbled upon Trevor Space, and I found that quite interesting. Can you just take a moment to share what this online community is?
Well, I mean, I can describe it in a way. I am well outside the target demographic. Can't actually use Trevor Space myself, but it is very much restricted to youth. So it's a safe space for youth to talk to each other without, you know, the worries that many would have about being outed, about things like that. So it is much like other forms of social media, except monitored to assure bullying and things don't happen. Our team is very intentional in making sure it's a very safe space for young people to interact with one another.
So Troy, I thank you for spending time with me, speaking about your organization, the Trevor Project.
Thank you so much for having me. I truly enjoyed it.
Troy Stevenson is the Senior Campaign Manager for the Trevor Project. You can find more information about the Trevor Project by visiting www.trevorproject.org. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media. Over the past 12 years, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Tips from Former Smokers campaign has helped millions of U.S. adults to quit smoking. Year after year, the Tips campaign has proven its effectiveness while promoting compelling messages and offering free resources to help adults quit smoking. This year, the Tips campaign features new people sharing their stories about how cigarette smoking and smoking-related diseases have negatively impacted their lives. Many of the new TIPS ads include messaging about the harms of menthol cigarettes, which can contribute to tobacco-related health disparities. Joining us now to share more information about the TIPS campaign is Diane Beistel, Chief of the Health Communications Branch with the CDC's Office on Smoking and Health. Diane, thank you so much for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you so much for having me on your show today.
Diane, I want to ask you, what is the overall goal of the TIPS campaign, and what makes this year's campaign so different?
Yeah, so the TIPS campaign launched in 2012, and it features real people telling their stories about how smoking impacted them and the lives of their loved ones. Since 2012, we've now featured 48 people who, from all walks of life, who have bravely shared their stories, inspiring millions of people to quit. This year, we are including messaging in the campaign and ads about the harms of smoking menthol cigarettes. Menthol is added to cigarettes, and what it does is it makes, there's a numbing and a cooling sensation, and it makes smoking easier to start and harder to quit. So many people who smoke associate that numbing and cooling sensation with a feeling of it being, you know, less harmful than regular cigarettes. So in this year's ads, we have messages about the fact that smoking menthol cigarettes are just as harmful as regular cigarettes.
So let me ask you, why are menthol cigarettes a concern?
Well, as I said, you know, menthol cigarettes now account for about 35% of all cigarettes sold in the United States. And, you know, for many people, they do associate that cooling cessation with the feeling that menthol cigarettes are healthier for them, when in fact, they're just as harmful as regular cigarettes. So the ads in this year's Tips from Former Smokers campaign help share stories about people who have smoked menthol cigarettes, and they let people know that, you know, quitting is possible and free help is available through 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
Diane, how has the campaign changed the lives of people who do, in fact, smoke?
Over the years, millions of people have been inspired to quit as a result of seeing the Tips ads, and 1 million have successfully quit for good because of the Tips for Former Smokers ads. And that's really because, you know, the people featured in the campaign, you know, bravely share their stories of what happened to them. And it's so motivating to other people to see people who are like them share their stories about, you know, how they've struggled, but how they've ultimately been successful in quitting.
So you mentioned earlier that this year's campaign features real people telling their stories, inspiring millions of people to quit, right? So I'm kind of curious, the real people that have shared their stories, what kind of tips, if any, kind of stand out that they have spoken about that have inspired so many to quit?
Well, one of the important things that the campaign does is it promotes free resources to help people quit, including the 1-800-QUIT-NOW number. And when people call 1-800-QUIT-NOW, they speak to a counselor who can get them set up with a quitting plan. And one of the most important things about setting up a quitting plan is identifying a quit date. They also talk to you about other strategies to help you be successful, like throwing away your ashtrays and lighters, by establishing a support system like your friends and family that you can turn to if you are feeling like you might, you know, want a cigarette. You can call somebody and they'll help talk you through it. It'll give you tips like, you know, practice some deep breathing exercises or go for a walk if you feel like smoking. A lot of times that craving that you're feeling, that urge for nicotine, will disappear if you can delay it for, you know, 15 minutes or so. And deep breathing and exercise is a great way to do that. I think another tip to help you be successful is to talk with your doctor about quitting. Even if you talked with them previously, they can help you set a quit date and prescribe you with quit smoking medicines if they think that would be helpful. There are currently 7 FDA-approved quit smoking medicines available, and we found that when you combine counseling like you would get from the 1-800-QUIT-NOW number with quit smoking medicines, you can double or triple your chances of successfully quitting.
Diane, in our short time together today, you have shared a lot of information about how the Tips campaign has helped people who smoke quit, as well as why menthol cigarettes are a concern. Now, for our listening audience that would like more information, where can they go?
If your audience wants to learn more about the new people featured in the campaign, they can go to cdc.gov/tips. On that website, you'll find the stories of the people featured in the campaign, not just the new people featured this year, but all of the people featured in all of the years of the campaign. And you'll also have access to a number of quitting resources. I've talked about 1-800-QUIT-NOW, but there's also information in there about the National Texting Portal. If you prefer to try quitting through a texting program, that might be for you. There's also information about a Quit Start app that was developed by the National Cancer Institute for people who prefer to use try quitting by the use of an app. That's another great option.
Diane Beistel is the chief of the Health Communications Branch with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Office on Smoking and Health. Diane, again, thank you so much for joining us on Regionally Speaking. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media.
Tune in for On Point daily at noon here on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM.
The Indiana Arts Commission announced on January 25th that Curtis L. Chrysler has been named the new Indiana Poet Laureate. Chrysler is the eighth Hoosier named to this honorary position and succeeds Matthew Graham, who has held the role since 2020. Chrysler was chosen by a selection committee that included seven representatives of Indiana's colleges and universities, as well as the Indiana Arts Commission Executive Director. Established in 2005, the Poet Laureate Program is meant to bring poetry to every corner of the state. Born and raised in Gary, Chrysler is a professor of English at Purdue University, Fort Wayne. An award-winning poet and author, Chrysler's Doing Drive-Bys on How to Love in the Midwest won the CNR Press Award for Poetry. He has published numerous other poetry books, young adult books, poetry chapbooks, has been anthologized in many publications, and published in a variety of magazines and journals. As Poet Laureate, Chrysler will make appearances in schools and libraries, as well as offer guidance to the Indiana Arts Commission concerning ways to further the art of poetry in Indiana and represent Indiana and the art of poetry to the community and public. Joining us now to talk about this exciting new honor is Curtis L. Chrysler himself. Curtis, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Ellen, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Now, I don't know if I should call you Mr. Chrysler, Professor Chrysler.
Just call me Curtis.
Wait a minute now, because you have so many titles. Should I call you Mr. Wordsmith or what? And the reason that I say that is because you are just so accomplished in everything that you do. But also, you were recently appointed Indiana's Poet Laureate. Not a small feat. Not a small feat at all, especially because the selection process was quite rigorous and you bested some of the greatest artists in the state. Now, before we look at your new designation, I want to spend a few moments walking through your genesis and what led you to poetry. And for a listening audience, I do want to also add that you are a region native. So walk me through your genesis.
Yeah, my father was from Chicago. My mother's from Gary, and she had me at 17. So that was young. And what's interesting about that in and of itself, there's a picture of me, her two brothers, and my sister at her graduation because she had to go to night school to get her degree. And this is back when it would be considered, I don't know, cruelty today, I would think. But I would watch my sister until she got home from school. And then, you know, she would come in. My sister would always be asleep. And she would come in and everything. And so I had to be 4 or 5 years old doing that.
Wow.
I was going to school on my own when I went to Washington Elementary School. I would have a key in my shoe. I would go, you know, walk to school, walked home, all that kind of stuff. So we were living in the projects by the Good Corner then over there. And then we moved to the Laney Project. And then my mother moved to the suburbs of Glen Ryan out by the beach towards work. And so I went to David O. Duncan to sixth grade. The year I got out of sixth grade, they moved sixth grade to middle school. That next year. So I went from David O. Duncan. I thought I was going to go to Beckman, like I said earlier. Well, when we were talking. And I didn't because we moved to Glen Ryan out by the beach. And then I went to Kennedy King. And then I ended up going to Wirt in Wirt High School. And I graduated from Wirt in 1983. And from there, I went to ITT in Fort Wayne, and I got my associate's degree in architectural engineering. And I set out for a couple of years. I was working like 3-4 jobs, doing all kind of stuff, cooking, modeling, just anything, dancing, doing crazy things. And then I went back to school after talking with my ex-girlfriend's father about the if I coulda, shoulda, wouldas. And it took me like 9 years to graduate. But I graduated, got my BA in English with a minor in theater. Then I went to grad school at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale and got my MFA in poetry. And I came back to Fort Wayne in 2004. I was working part-time. Then I got on to visiting. Then I got full. Then I got tenure. And in 2022, I recently got a full professor. So now it's just Professor Chrysler instead of having associate professor or assistant professor. And yeah, now I'm the Poet Laureate for Indiana, which is still blowing my mind.
Blowing your mind.
Yeah.
You know, I'm amazing as you share with us, with our listening audience, your genesis. And I'm trying to wrap my mind around from young adulthood. That part of your story where you shared with us that you have a degree in architectural engineering. And I'm trying to wrap my mind around to understand how you go from that to modeling and dancing to now being, and obviously professor, to now being Indiana's Poet Laureate. And I know you said you're still trying to wrap your mind around it, and it's exciting, mm-hmm. but I just have to ask you, like, are you really taking it in?
Well, it's I haven't really had time to take it in
because it's
just been like so overwhelming. I don't know how many interviews I've done. The emails, the texts, the phone calls have been really. I mean, for me, I'm a very laid back type of person, so I enjoy my downtime as well as my uptime and stuff like that. So usually I have time. You know, I plan. Hey, y'all want to go out to get some brunch or something like that, and I'll hang out with, someone and we'll do that. But now I still have my Christmas tree up. I haven't had time to take down my Christmas tree.
Oh, wow.
That's how crazy it's been.
Wow. Wow. Well, full disclosure, I still have my Christmas decorations on my porch. So full disclosure. So you're okay. Now let me ask you, how were you even chosen as Indiana's Poet Laureate?
Well, you go through this process. So what happened? So in 2020, my friend put my name in and I made it to the finals in 2020. But two people that were on the committee knew me, so they had to recuse themselves. And my friend who put my name in, she said something to the effect, well, you should try again. I was like, oh, I don't think so. I don't, and for some reason I was thinking about her and I said, okay, I'll try again for Marcy. And so I put my name in, and then you go through the aspects of following the questions, and then they have different things for you. Like there's after the first set of questions and things that you get, if you made it into the next phase, then they had interviews with you and stuff like that. So I had a Zoom interview with the committee. And then after that, I had another Zoom interview with the director of IAC. And so then that's when she told me. So, yeah, they want to know basically about you, how you look at stuff, what you plan to do, how you're going to get poetry out there, be a steward of poetry and things of that nature.
Right, right. So, and I was going to ask you, so this program is meant to bring poetry to every corner of the state, right? So take a moment to share with our listening audience really and truly what this means for the Hoosier State, and how will you in your 2-year term bring poetry to every corner of the state?
Well, I think the overall thing is just hearing a voice from a Hoosier who's like me, and for people who look like me to see that. And I think that's really powerful because I'm the second African-American Indiana Poet Laureate. And my friend actually who was the first was Adrian Matita. We went to SIU together. So it's kind of crazy that, there's all these commonalities that are happening around that overlap in that sense. So there's that. But I want to get out there and bring poetry to the people. I want to go to all the places I can in this 2-year span to commune with everyone. My thing, I do what I call an Indiana Chitlin Circuit, which plays off the Chitlin Circuit that they had back in the day where blacks couldn't go into establishments and stuff like that. They had to come in the back, or if they were coming to town, like just like they had the Green Book and all that stuff, there are places they could go. So they were playing more like in juke joints and stuff like that after hours. And people will have them come in, you know, they give them a little money, they could sell their wares and stuff like that, and, you know, then they get out. So the Indiana Children's Circuit is like that, that I do at school. It's just me doing it. So I try, if I have the money, to bring poets in, and we do a little, I introduce them, then we do a round robin of all the poets. Then everybody, usually with the way I do it at school, is each poet gets like 20 minutes or 25 minutes to read their stuff. Then we read a poem together, and then after we have a Q&A and sometimes food or something to that extent. And I want to take that on the road. I want to do what I'm calling the pop-up Indiana Children's Circuit, to where I'm meeting the people where they are. So we're going to find a couple of poets. We're going to get together, have a little jam session, do a workshop, hopefully have aspects of music, you know, in whatever part of Indiana I'm in, and try something like, you know, having this opportunity where you can have food trucks come out, or catering, but aspects of people to bring food, their food trucks, to the event, so that it can be an event and we can commune and address that in like a 3-hour span or something like that. So I want to do that kind of like once a month in different places. Every month.
As you are describing that, it sounds exciting because it takes me back to the times, the stories that my grandparents would share with me about, mm-hmm. as you shared, the Chitlin Circuit. It's not some big, grand venue where you come and you're dressed up and it's a little stuffy. It takes mm-hmm. me back to a more intimate environment where people feel more relaxed, and then people are more receptive as well as to the art.
Well, I hope so.
but people who may not be familiar with or comfortable with in that space, mm-hmm. that kind of an environment, it lends itself to be very, I don't even know if the word is, you're an English prof, so I don't know if mm-hmm. the word is comfortable, but inviting.
Well,
maybe
so.
Inviting.
I'm hoping it's inviting and receptive, in the sense that I'm not trying to change them. They're not trying to change. I'm just wanting to be open and learn and take things in, just as I'm giving things as well. What I say I do is I call it a urban Midwestern sensibility, which means I'm looking at the lives of people who've made it from the Great Migration from like 1917 to 1970, and I'm looking at their past, present, and future lives, and that's what I tend to write about, because all the people that are in Gary, in Michigan, in the tri-state area, are usually from Mississippi, Alabama, you know, that kind of thing. And they bring their cultures with them and things of that nature. So what I'm writing about is this thing, that this phenomenon that happened, to where people who left the South and came up North are a big part of the change in how cities are made and built. They had to build up. So, you know, Chicago, New York, places like that, smaller places, but they have to build up so that you can occupy those people that came. And they came because of the steel mills and things of that nature at that time that were, you know, starting to boom, and so they can get jobs, send money back to the South to their people and stuff like that, or set up to where those people can end up moving up to the North with them. So in looking at that, these are the people I'm looking, you know, when I think about my grandmother, my grandfather, my father's side or my mother's side, that's what they were doing. And Chrysler is a German name. So you have that aspect of the Germans who came to Illinois and Indiana to farm. And, you know, so there's a whole aspect of this melting pot that is us, but we don't want to look at that. It seems like we don't look beyond the color of our skin sometimes, in that sense.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, Curtis, while being named Indiana's Poet Laureate is a big deal, I want to focus on you some more, because you've already shared, you count this as an honor, you count this honor as one of many that you have received over the years. And just in our conversation today and everything that I've read about you, I just find that you are just so humble. But the arts community has just been so generous with its praise for your work. I want you to share a few of the honors that you have received, including, if you don't mind, talking a bit about one of the pieces of work you've done, doing drive-bys on how to love in the Midwest. And I understand that won an award as well.
Yes, that's my latest book. And it CNR Press picked it as the winner. And actually, it's been a while. So it was in, they picked it as a winner in 2022. And then things happened. There were some setbacks. So we were working on it from like June, I think, last year, all the way through December, and got it. The publishing date was December 31st, 2023. So it is just out. It's fresh out. And it's a labor of love. It's the poem, the titular poem for the book comes from me and one of my friends who is in the nursing home, and I go visit her. And the nursing home that she was in were run by the Catholics, and so she had a lot of nuns and stuff around her. So I would go up to Huntington. And we went to undergrad together. And so she's older now, and she's dealing with a lot of different things. And it was just something about, she likes coffee. So we went to this Starbucks. They had just built the Starbucks. I'm not a coffee person. I'm not a Starbucks person. So okay. I went because of her. I just, you know, I love her. So I went because of her. And so we go in there, and everybody's looking at me. And she happens to be white. And everybody there happens to be white. So there was this kind of thing that I was looking at and how people were looking at me. So I talk about that in the poem. And it became the title poem for the book. And so it's kind of like me disregarding them and the microaggressions and all that stuff and just focusing on her. So it's a powerful poem. It's what I call a tornado poem. It's turned sideways, so you have to read it. You have to turn the book like 180 degrees or 90 degrees, I think, to read it. And so it goes on for like 3 or 4 pages of just spinning like a funnel cloud, you know, like a tornado funnel. And it looks like that. And so there's a couple of poems in the book like that. So that was really cool to win the prize. And then for all the stuff that we did to make the book what it is, I think the book turned out really beautifully, how it looks, how it's shaped, what we did with it. And now we're just trying to get it out there, get it to places to get reviewed. I'm actually going to be in Kansas City later this week at AWP. It's a conference for writers. So I'm going to be reading at 3 different venues. One of the other places I'm a fellow at is Kavi Kainum, and that reading is on Thursday. Reading is on Wednesday. There's a reading on Thursday for CNR Press, which published doing drive-bys on how to love in the Midwest. And then on Friday, there's a reading for my friend does these poet baseball cards where he has poets on baseball, like a baseball card instead of baseball players. So you have your picture and you have your stats on the back, and we're doing a reading for that. So it's been, Kavi Kainum was a big thing because they're an African-American institution who brings in African-Americans each year and gives them, you have 3 years to become a fellow, but you meet with the top African-American writers. Yusef Komunyakaa, Cornelius Eady, and Troy Derricott started the whole thing. And Kavi Kainum has just blown up everything in my life. And so since 2000, I knew about him before that, but I think the first time I went was 2003. And so it has changed my life. They have where you do a workshop, you do workshops in the summer. Every day you're with a significant elder or honored poet in the publishing game. And since then, I mean, I've met, I think, in just being in Coffee Canem, I've now met every African American, at least, who's gotten a Pulitzer Prize. At least if I don't know them, I've met them. And so I never wow. thought I would be sitting across from, sitting across from Yusef Komunyakoo or Terrence Hayes or, you know, Nikki Finney or whoever it is. And I'm sitting across from them, and I'm sitting across from Cornelius Eady. And I'm like, man, I told him, I hate you. And he's like, whoa, brother, what's up? And because he wrote this book, Brutal Imagination, and he brings Mr. Zero to life. I'm trying to think, Susan, I can't think of her last name, but remember the woman that drove her two sons into the river?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So he brings to life this black man that everybody is imagining, and he has him in the car driving, looking behind him, and there's two, you know, the two white kids are behind him. And the way he does the arc of the book, the first half of that book, is he does that, and when she confesses, Mr. Zero disappears, and all of it comes back on her. Oh. But I was like, man, you said everything everybody wants to say.
Wow.
You said it in that book. It was it's a beautiful book. So stuff like being in places that I needed to be, Coffee Canem, the VCCA in Virginia, wherever I am, it's just made me more vigilant to understanding, yeah, I'm in the right place. This is what I'm supposed to be doing.
Now, in addition to all of your acclaimed works of art, you are also a professor of English at Purdue University, Fort Wayne. So, First of all, how do you manage it all? And secondly, what has been the response to you being Indiana's Poet Laureate on the campus community?
Well, the campus, I was surprised because, so of the eight people that have been Poet Laureate, one of them was George Calamars, was my mentor, then peer, then friend, who was two offices back to the left. And so now we have me there, like within a 10-year span. So you have two poet laureates at the same school. And so
wow.
they're just jumping for joy and have been really, really accommodating and loving and giving me the love on this. Like, I can't believe, you know, you deserve it. You know, and and it's all that. And I'm glad that they, I feel in one sense, I feel seen in that sense. And I think this is what other people want that look like me. And I want that for them too. And I want them to see me and use that to see that, hey, you can do this. And to be, you know, one is not the only African-American full professor on the campus in 2024 is crazy to me, but look at what you can do. And so I want them to see that. And it is hard to do all of this. I remember telling the classes, you know, because I had to keep it hush-hush for a while. And then when I told them, they were just like, one of my classes, because I've had a few of the people in that class before, they just blew their tops. But it gives them credit too. So when I'm writing letters of recommendation for my students to go to grad school or to get a job or to work in a writing center or whatever, and then I have Poet Laureate of Indiana or Indiana Poet Laureate on there, that just boosts, you know, it's like, one, I know this dude, you know.
Right.
But two, it's like, I think it gives them some aspect of credence by association for some reason. I think it just, it can help them out in that sense. And I just want to put that spotlight on it so that, you know, that does that for them so they can get into places that they need to be into and get the, you know, have this thing that I'm doing in their lives.
Absolutely. Now, Curtis, before I let you go, because we've spent some time talking about just a few of your works of art, how can our listening audience find the complete list of all of your works so that they can go ahead and get more information about you?
Well, the complete list is on my CV, so they can contact poetcrisler.com. So that's poetcrisler.com. poetcrisler.com, and they can, you know, contact me, and if they need to see the CV or anything like that, I can send it to them so they can, you know, to get that. On the website, though, it doesn't have everything I've done, but it has a lot of what I've done, because some books are out of print and things of that nature. But they have, I think, 10 or 11 books on there. Of the 13 that I have.
Curtis, when I say that, and I don't say this quite often, and I've had the privilege and the honor to speak to so many people from the Hoosier State, and particularly in Northwest Indiana, but when I say to you that I have really and truly enjoyed our time together, I mean, I thank you for being generous, number one, with your time.
Oh, no problem.
But number two, I thank you for sharing so much, because, you know, as you were talking, I was writing notes of, wow, he said this, he said that. So I want to, I mean, you're just awesome. You're so humble. You're so awesome. So I want to say to you that, number one, I am just so glad that you shared that you feel seen. That's powerful. Like you said it, but someone is going to hear that, and that will be so inspirational for them. So I'm glad that you feel seen. More importantly, I am so glad that you are serving as a representation of the Black diaspora.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
And I just want to conclude by saying this, that I look forward to seeing you on your crisscross tour across the state for your Chitlin Circuit style tour. So I cannot wait. I'm going to tune in to Indiana Arts Commission so that I can take a look at your schedule, because I will be sure to share that information with our listening audience, and I will be sure that I am a part of that audience.
Oh, great. Thanks. I really appreciate it. And thanks for having me on. I can't say enough about being a representation of, you know, where I come from. And hopefully I can do something that does help other people feel seen as well. You know, so that's the goal. And so when I go out here, I'm hoping that happens.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media. The nation's largest single investment in Catholic grade schools was announced in Northwest Indiana on Wednesday. Lakeshore Public Media's Michael Gallenberger reports.
The Dean and Barbara White Family Foundation says it's giving $150 million to the Big Shoulders Fund over the next 10 years. That money will impact all 20 schools of the Diocese of Gary, according to Big Shoulders Fund CEO Josh Hale.
This transformational donation will open many doors, allowing the creation and enhancement of curriculum, providing advanced and professional development and growth opportunities for teachers and school leadership, assisting with enrollment and tuition management, providing infrastructure improvements where needed, and perhaps most importantly, creating valuable support services to meet the learning needs of all these children.
Big Shoulders plans to target that money toward communities with the greatest economic and educational need. Gary Bishop Robert McClory says the diocese is still working with Big Shoulders and what specifically that'll look like.
So it means to make sure that our schools are accessible to those who seek them out, to make sure that the quality is there, providing the support and the sustainability. And that includes a wide range of things to make sure that we're able to not just have a nice boost, but to sustain this over time.
The bishop also announced that the diocese plans to establish a separate endowment fund, which it hopes to grow up to $50 million to boost compensation for its teachers, principals, and other school staff. This comes as Indiana's made funding more available to private schools through its voucher program. A 2023 law significantly eased the income requirements for its choice scholarship, and the state paid $439 million in tuition grants to private schools this past school year. McClory says the Diocese of Gary has seen enrollments increase at its schools, but he stresses that they'll maintain their Catholic identities even as they become more accessible to all.
Right now, if you look overall, about 22% of our enrollment is non-Catholic, and so we always open the doors to make sure that those who want a quality Catholic education have that opportunity.
State-level officials were also part of Wednesday's announcement, including Secretary of Education Dr. Katie Jenner and Governor Eric Holcomb. Holcomb says investments in education play a big role in Hoosiers' pursuit of happiness.
Indiana has never been more devoted as a state to making sure that Indiana is a place for all to get on that path, to have that pathway lit up.
Indiana House Speaker Todd Houston also made the trip, saying Wednesday's event was his favorite of those he's attended as speaker.
This event changes generations. This event changes outcomes.
Still, Holcomb says the state remains committed to funding traditional public schools.
The bottom line is always to make sure families can identify the best scenario for their student to grow and flourish in the classroom as well.
Dean and Barbara White Family Foundation trustee Beth White says a $150 million donation will serve as a beacon for the region's youth.
That will provide values-based education and performance-driven education for decades to come.
For Lakeshore News, I'm Michael Gallenberger.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for this week. Thanks to our guests, Curtis Chrysler, Troy Stevenson from the Troy Project, and Michael Gallenberger from All Things Considered. And we'll be back with you next week with an all-new show.